From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the flurry of court challenges to proposals headed for the November ballot.
It's a lot cheaper and maybe easier to defeat a ballot proposal before it ever gets on the ballot by knocking it down in court.
A Metro Detroit suburb having a change of heart about public transportation.
For many years, there's been this prevailing idea that, well, Novi doesn't really need buses and doesn't really want buses. And we had to break through that.
Why there is no Lyme vaccine for humans.
You know, since Lyme disease was named, essentially, there was controversy over what exactly Lyme disease is, despite the fact that, from a medical point of view, it seems pretty straightforward.
And summer reading picks, including Lillian Lee's number one Chinese restaurant.
One of the younger characters says every day at a Chinese restaurant was bring your kid to work day.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Last week, two more business organizations opted to formally challenge proposals headed for the November ballot. The group Michigan Opportunity, led by the Michigan Restaurant Association, is leading opposition against the minimum wage proposal. Separately, attorneys for business organizations such as Small Business for a Better Michigan have sought to block a proposal that would require employers to offer paid sick time. And the Michigan Chamber of Commerce has been leading the effort to head off the proposal that would change the way electoral districts are drawn up in our state. The Michigan Supreme Court is set to hear arguments in that challenge on Wednesday. So what do these challenges to voter initiatives tell us about the current state of politics in Michigan? With us now to help sort it all out is Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News Service. It's always great to have you here, Zach.
Hi, Cindy. Great to be here.
So we're seeing more and more of these challenges to ballot initiatives emerging. And I'm wondering, is this out of the ordinary or is this pretty typical and it's just been a while since we've had meaningful ballot initiatives?
More the latter. You know, the last time we had this many meaningful ballot initiatives was 2012, and there were a lot of challenges then, too. The theory is basically it's a lot cheaper and maybe easier to defeat a ballot proposal before it ever gets on the ballot by knocking it down in court. Once it's on the ballot, then you're looking at potentially millions of dollars that have to be spent to defeat it, as opposed to maybe tens of thousands of dollars for attorneys to defeat it in court.
Zach, the three significant challenges are all coming from deep-pocketed business groups, the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, the Michigan Restaurant Association, and a group of various small business organizations. What is the opposition from these groups to these initiatives, and conversely, the liberal support for the initiatives? What does all of that say to you about the state of Michigan politics today?
Well, the reason I think the proposals have come about at all is you've had almost 8 years now of total Republican control of the government. So if you are left of center and you embrace left of center policy proposals like raising the minimum wage so that tipped employees make the same minimum wage as everyone else, requiring employers to provide paid sick time to their employees, an independent redistricting commission, you're shut out in the legislature. Those are items the legislature, under Republican control, is not going to pursue. So the only alternative, then, if you can't get control of the legislature and the governor's office, is a ballot proposal. And thus, organizations like the Michigan Chamber of Commerce and several of these business organizations that tend to prefer Republican control of government, some of these associations do endorse some Democrats for the legislature, but on the whole, they are generally endorsing mostly Republicans. So they do not favor these proposals, and thus they're going to lead the opposition to them.
But interestingly, the ballot proposal to make recreational marijuana legal is not being challenged. So why do you think that is? Because it's certainly plenty controversial.
You know, that's a good question. I think maybe the opposition got caught a little flat-footed. You know, you don't have the same super passionate opposition on that side as you do with these business groups. You know, look, whether you agree with these business organizations or disagree with them, and whether you favor increasing the minimum wage or not, you can understand why a business organization would have a very strong opinion one way or the other on those proposals. So thus, they're going to put some skin in the game on this. But, you know, there's no passionate deep pockets to oppose marijuana legalization yet. And so you didn't have someone, you know, fly-specking the language to say, well, you know, is there anything we can try to challenge here legally, or can we go after the signatures? And thus, no challenge was filed. I did see some grousing on social media from some Republican consultants that was a mistake, that somebody should have challenged the signatures and or the legality of the proposal to see if it could be defeated before it got to the ballot.
Now, there is another ballot initiative, Promote the Vote, that would allow no reason absentee voting by mail. It would guarantee continued straight party voting and let people register to vote up to and on Election Day. And that group just submitted its signatures earlier this month. There hasn't been any opposition yet, but do you expect that to change?
Yeah, I suspect we will see some organization indirectly tied to Republican interests materialize to try to defeat this, whether that means a signature challenge. Lately, when it comes to constitutional amendments, all the rage for opponents to say, well, they haven't listed all the sections that would be amended or altered or abrogated by their proposal. So I would suspect somebody who has ties to the Republican Party in Michigan is going to come after this and try to stop it. But so far, that hasn't happened yet.
Zach Gorchow from Gongwer News Service. As always, Zach, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's something about the sound of a crackling campfire being surrounded by the looming mystery of a nighttime forest that creates the perfect atmosphere for telling a special kind of story. Some campfire stories aim to send a shiver down your spine. Others seek to remember a past moment in history or perhaps teach a good life's lesson. With that tradition in mind, we're bringing you a series of campsite stories. We begin with Jennifer Strauss, a professional storyteller based in Traverse City. Growing up in Metro Detroit, Jen spent her summers attending Tamarack camps. It's a Jewish summer camp run by the Fresh Air Society in Bloomfield Hills, with base camps in Ortonville and Shingleton, and an outpost in Wawa, Ontario. Many of the stories that ended up in Jennifer's professional repertoire of tales were stories that she originally heard at camp many years ago, like the one you're about to hear.
So Camp Tamarack, or Tamarack Camps, is a Jewish camp. And a lot of what we did had to do with Jewish education and a lot of other wonderful activities. Our camp director, when I was growing up in that camp, was a wonderful storyteller. And he often told stories that had great lessons in them. And this is one that I heard when I was about 12 years old from our director. It's called The Grain of Rice. Once there was a master teacher, and she taught wisely, and she taught well. Until there came a time when she had four prize students. They spent all of their time studying and discussing great things together. There came a time when their teacher came to them and told them that she was going to be away for a long time. She was going to be off and traveling so that she could bring more wisdom and knowledge back to them. The students protested. They wondered how they would know what to study or what to learn in her absence. But she assured them that they would know exactly what to do. She said, I have a gift for each one of you, something I want you to study. She had them open up their hands, and in each one of the students' hands, she placed one grain of rice. She said, I want you to keep this grain of rice, and when I return, I want you to give it back to me and tell me what you've learned. The first student looked down at that grain of rice. She thought, oh, this is a gift from my teacher, and she's given it to me. She must think I'm very special. And she wrapped a golden thread around that grain of rice, put it in a jeweled box, and showed everyone the gift that her teacher had given to her. The second student knew that it was a gift from her teacher, and she knew that it was important to keep it safe so she could give it back when the teacher returned. So she placed it in a wooden box. She put it underneath her bed and didn't let anyone see it. She wanted to make sure that she had it when her teacher came back. The third student, she looked at that grain of rice in her hand. She thought it looked like any other grain of rice that she had seen. So she threw it on the floor, knowing that when her teacher came back, she could easily find another grain of rice to give to her. But the fourth student, she took that grain of rice and she studied it. She studied it for a week. She studied it for a month. She finally realized that the grain of rice in her hand was a seed. And so she went out and she planted that seed. In time, the rice grew. And when it was time to harvest, why, she took some of that harvested rice. She gave some to others who needed it. She kept some for herself. And she took seeds and again planted them in the ground. It was several seasons before their teacher returned. They were excited to see her, and they were curious to know what lessons she would bring back to them. She asked them where the grain of rice was, and she came before each student to find out what they had done with it. The first student showed her teacher the beautiful jeweled box with a grain of rice that had been wrapped in gold thread and said, "I knew this was a special gift from you to me, and so I showed it to everyone so that they would know that you're my teacher." She gave her the box. The teacher bowed and said, "Thank you." The second student stepped forward with the wooden box and said, "I knew this was a special gift, and I wanted to have it to give it back to you, and so I kept it in this wooden box underneath my bed and didn't let anyone see it." She handed her the box, and the teacher said, "Thank you." While the first two students were explaining what they had done with the seed, the third student had run into the kitchen, looked around on the floor, picked up a grain of rice and brought it back, handed it to her teacher, said, "This looks like any other grain of rice, so I give this back to you." The teacher said, "Thank you." When she came before the fourth student, that student held nothing in her hands. The teacher asked what she had done with that grain of rice, and the student took her out to the fields, showed her the rice that had grown. She said, "I studied the grain of rice for a week and for a month and finally realized it was a seed. So I planted it, and this is what has resulted." And the master teacher looked at her and said, "You have learned the true meaning of knowledge and wisdom. You plant the seeds of knowledge and you let them grow. You harvest the wisdom. You keep some for yourself. You give some to others and put more seeds back into the ground." And so that student became a master teacher herself, and she taught wisely and she taught well.
Jennifer Strauss is a professional storyteller. Her business is Story Be Told. She's based in Traverse City and travels nationally, helping educators, organizations, businesses, and individuals use stories to connect and communicate. And let us know what campfire stories you grew up hearing, what made them memorable. You can email us, stateside@michiganradio.org, or leave us a message by calling 734-764-7840. That's 734-764-7840. Tell us the gist of the story, where you heard it, why it's so good. We'd love to hear from you. Coming up, we discuss whether or not a Lyme disease vaccine will ever make a comeback in this country. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the very, very best ways to enjoy a Michigan summer is to park yourself under a tree or on a beach and get lost in a good book. So let's get some great picks for your summer reading as we welcome poet Keith Taylor. He has just retired as creative writing teacher at the University of Michigan, and we should note has just published another chapbook called Ecstatic Destinations, written about his Ann Arbor neighborhood. Keith Taylor, let's talk books.
All right, Cindy, let's go.
And these are all written by Michigan authors?
They're all people who have connections to Michigan. Okay?
Okay,
I can explain those if you want.
Sure.
Nick Dybeck, the first one, grew up in Kalamazoo, did his undergraduate degree at the University of Michigan, then left for that famous Iowa writer's school and now teaches in Oregon, I think.
Okay.
And he's the son of Stuart Dybeck, one of our famous short story writers from back in the day.
All right, so it's in the blood. And his book starts us off in the aftermath of World War
I. It does. It's one of those historical novels that's in this great tradition of historical novels.
And what is the title?
The Verdun Affair. So when you do a novel like this, clearly you do a lot of research, and he's done that. So there's the history, and then the novelist gets to infest that history with vibrant characters, which is kind of fun. These novels often end up being about memory, and they often end up being about the changing identities of the main characters who are changed by the history they're involved with. So in this one, there's a young man, well, actually a boy, he's 15 when he first goes to France right in 1915, and his father's a doctor working on the front lines with the American Field Service, that the doctors were there several years before the American Army showed up. So and his doctor brings him over and he has his son with him on the front lines. Father dies. Tom stays in France and he lives with priests who have the responsibility of honoring the nameless dead. So after the war, he stays around. And he stays right in Verdun. So he stayed. Verdun was the largest battle in World War I, lasted almost a year.
Terrible battle.
Yeah, over a million casualties, hundreds of thousands killed, and most of them blasted apart. You couldn't recognize most of the bodies. So he would walk around the fields of battle and collect bones, which then get placed in a giant ossuary, which will then be sacralized and become a memorial. It's grim work. So for years after the war, families and friends come to the battlefield with an impossible hope that they can find word of their missing loved ones. The love interest, Sarah, she comes too, even though she understands the impossibility better than some of them, and then she and Tom have the affair that is in the title. Soon, however, they leave for Italy, also a place where there was major battles, not the horrible trench warfare of France, but major battles. And there's a famous amnesiac who got a lot of attention in the press, and I think that's a historical moment. And Sarah thinks he might be her husband. Tom has constructed, because Tom's in love with her, he's constructed stories and lies that support her hopes, partly so he can be with her. So that's complicated enough. And then, of course, there are also lots of other complications. But he also gives us small moments in Tom's later life where he works as a writer in Hollywood in 1950. Dramatic contrast.
Very much so.
Yeah.
So do you have an excerpt for us?
I do.
Because you reading to me is one of my favorite things about doing Stateside.
Well, we could just start doing it. This is a little moment. So he can, with all that research, he can construct these moments. This could be considered a first date. So they go out and they go to a beat-up circus, which really doesn't have much right after the war, but it does have dancing bears. And this is just a beautiful description Dybeck wrote about these dancing bears. The man with the blue handkerchief had already jumped from his seat and fallen on his backside. He was trying to pedal backward through the mud. The bears, by the way, have changed their demeanor toward the audience. That's what's making him do that. The bear blurred toward the front of the stage, and somehow I knew, and it wasn't just the narcissism of fear, that the bear was coming straight for us. Not the crowd, but Sarah and me. I put my arm across her chest, but couldn't find the strength in my legs. And then the bear was before us, directly before us. And I could feel Sarah against my arm, stiff as the dead but blaring heat. The bear reared on his hind legs. We were close enough to smell its breath of earth and meat. Then the bear smiled. He smiled. The corners of his mouth turned up like a man's. He smiled and galloped back to the three trainers and the other bear, the men standing with straight backs, then the five of them bowing to the crowd.
Ooh, that's good.
And that's, I mean, I picked that because it's kind of, it's indicative of the kinds of things he can do, which is amazing.
Wonderful. And now we're going to poetry.
Yeah, now this would be both the novels, that one and the novel we'll talk about in a minute, are certainly summer reads. This is a wonderful book of poems, but it's heavy. You have to make an investment in this. Involved with some of those same questions of identity that get into the historical novels, but this, of course, is in contemporary poetry, so it's different. This is Tarfia Faizullah, Registers of Illuminated Villages. Tarfia Vizula is from Midland, Texas. She grew up there, and then she has that sort of classic Texas twang in her speech. But she is a first-generation child of Bangladeshi-American parents. Her first collection of poems was based on a good deal of research and historical interviews in Bangladesh, where she talked with women who'd been systematically raped during the Bangladesh War for Independence in the early 70s. Vizula's poems don't simply record the facts or quote the subjects, but inhabit the material in a kind of profound and intimate way. This new collection, Registers of Illuminated Village, takes up some of the same ideas of the first, but are mostly placed in America, mostly placed in Faizullah's experience of this country as a brown-skinned Muslim girl, then woman, in post-9/11 America. Her parents in Texas send her to a private Episcopal school where she was the only Muslim and where she learned to say all the prayers. I am an infidel in this classroom church. I kneel with the other, restless on the cracked leather kneeler.
Whew.
And here's a little prose poem about the experience of prejudice, even before the most obvious waves of it were released after 9/11. So just try to imagine a child hearing this kind of thing. It's called Your Own Country. That wasn't the same day two towers staggered into the ground. You were warned they'd be hunting us, but you didn't want to be soft. There's a first day you learn a country can't be earned. Your heart's embarrassed. Ishuf. It is soft. It isn't soft at all. A shiny pickup drives past. Go back to your own country, they holler. A firecracker lit, then thrown. There's a first day you learn ours and theirs. The girl with curious fingers says hello. Her friends scorn, you'll get whatever they have. The skylight pours down all that white at home. What about the poor people in our country? Do you want to be like them? Is that it? Then go, go. There's a first day you learn how to kill yourself without dying. Your own country demands it. This isn't new. It isn't news.
Boy, that's harsh.
Yeah, she's dealing with the big subjects, real big subjects.
Does she live in Michigan now?
She lived here until a month ago. She taught at U of M for 4 years. She had a lovely position for young poets and then left and is now going to be teaching at the Art Institute of Chicago School. So she's not going far away.
Not at all.
Right.
And now we turn to a debut novel.
A debut novel, Lillian Lee, who does live in Michigan now. She just finished her MFA, and even though her first book is out, she still feels she needs a day job, so she works over at Literati Bookshop right here in Ann Arbor. This book, it's called The Number One Chinese Restaurant. As the title might suggest, it's another immigrant story. This one's a multi-generational tale about Chinese immigrants and their restaurant, the Beijing Duck House, outside Washington. There's some gentle humor in this book, but there's also a lot of love. One of the younger characters says, every day at a Chinese restaurant was bring your kid to work day.
Which is nice. True. Yeah. I've seen that.
Yeah. But you can't get the wrong impression. This is a serious book about the way these people have learned to live and work in America. The majority culture, even though it surrounds these people and provides the context for their success at business, plays almost no role in their lives or in this book, although it rewards and punishes. But there are deep loyalties between these people, loyalties that cover two continents and traverse a very large ocean, loyalties that govern actions of the characters, even when they know they might be doing something harmful or destructive. And there's a lot of action in Lee's novel, often page-turning, dramatic action. I don't want to give essentials away, but there are moments of betrayal, moments of violence, moments of fear, and there are ways these are resolved and how the characters are sustained by their community. And here's this lovely little moment of cooking in a Chinese restaurant. He cranked the burner as high as it would go until the air in front of his face shimmered with heat. Then he dropped his ladle into the drum of peanut oil by the wok, pouring it straight into the pan. Always more oil, he demanded. More, even more. He swirled the oil around in his wok, coating the entire surface, then poured the oil back into the drum. Filling his ladle partway again, he wet the wok with one more splash of oil and cracked eggs into the gleaming puddle. Stirring the yellow around, he grabbed a container of rice, dumped it in, mixing the rice into the oil and eggs. He lifted the wok with his left hand. One heavy flick, and the rice transformed into a wave, cresting over the edge of the rim and breaking back down into the corner of the pan. Again, do it until your wrist breaks.
somebody knows her restaurant Chinese cooking,
somebody
doesn't
has done
she?
That.
Wow.
Yeah,
I can tell you're very enthused about these books.
I am. Yes, those are wonderful. They're wonderful books. And the novels, of course, are what people look for in summer reads. Book of Poems is a worthwhile, is certainly going to repay a close reading.
And we cannot let you go, Keith Taylor, without having you read a poem or so from your new chapbook, Ecstatic Destinations, which is about your neighborhood in Ann Arbor.
It is. It all started with, as I get to a certain age, Cindy, I've got to walk around to get a little thing. So I walk the triangle, Dexter Road to North Maple, down North Maple, back on Jackson, about a mile and a half.
Okay.
Sometimes I walk very slowly, and I stop and talk to everybody, and I stop and watch people at the skate park and people playing baseball. And so, it's sort of all added up. As you can tell by looking at me, I'm really not very active in sports. But if you live in Ann Arbor, you have to be. And there are sports all the way through this little book, which is kind of fun. And, of course, this one, which everybody in Ann Arbor knows, Football Saturday. The lights stay green for 5 minutes at a stretch so the cars coming in from the north can keep the school flags flying from their back windows. A maple leaf, burnt sienna, catches in my beard, and two vultures riding what thermals they can find after the night of first frost turn above me, looking for carrion. When our team loses badly, the streets are quieter, filled with gentle sadness, subdued, humble.
Very true.
Yep.
Well, just to recap our summer picks from our wonderful, wonderful Keith Taylor, we have The Verdun Affair by Nick Dybeck. We have Registers of Illuminated Villages by Tarfia Fazula. And Number One Chinese Restaurant by Lillian Lee, the debut novel. And, of course, Ecstatic Destinations by my guest Keith Taylor. And if you were not able to write these titles down, no worries, because we've got them on the Stateside page at michiganradio.org just for you. Keith Taylor, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
If you're out in wooded or brushy areas this summer and want to avoid Lyme disease, here's the advice of the day. You wear long sleeves and pants. You tuck your pant cuffs into your socks. Check yourself regularly for ticks, which spread the disease. But for a time in the late 90s and early 2000s, people had the option to take an even more preventative step. They could get a Lyme disease vaccine. No longer. To explain the history of Lyme disease in this country and why getting that vaccine is no longer an option, Dr. Robert A. Aronowitz is with us now, a medical doctor and professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Doctor, welcome.
Great to be here.
Can you give us, first of all, the Cliff Notes version of Lyme disease in this country, its discovery and where it's concentrated, and really the nature of this disease?
Yeah, so it was discovered, and I'll put that in air quotes, in the mid-1970s in New England, and it has the name Lyme disease from Lyme, Connecticut, where there was an epidemic or a cluster of childhood arthritis and fever and other unexplained symptoms. At first, they thought it must be a virus because there was a lot of interest in viruses that cause arthritis. But a few years later, an entomologist named Willie Bergdorfer discovered that a bacteria, spirochete, was in the gut of a tick in an area that was endemic for what was then called Lyme disease. You know, since Lyme disease was named, essentially, there was controversy over what exactly Lyme disease is, despite the fact that from a medical point of view, it seems pretty straightforward, and the medical discovery seemed pretty quick, including its response to antibiotics.
So if you were looking at Lyme disease from the orthodoxy point of view, that it means the medical establishment, how widespread and how serious is this disease today?
Well, it's a serious disease. It's the most common tick-borne infection. You know, it's reportable to the CDC. I had Lyme disease twice. Let me tell you, it can be painful. You have a very severe flu-like illness. And sometimes that's associated with things like arthritis, chronic rash, Bell's palsy, which is a paralysis of the facial nerve, which can be very scary, especially to parents of children who are affected. But I think the orthodox point of view is that most of the time it's self-limited, it's treatable by antibiotics, and only in very rare cases does it cause anything like chronic symptoms, and they're very circumscribed. That is, there's a kind of chronic skin condition, there's potential for neurological manifestations in the form of pain and coming down the leg and the back in the weeks after infection, or in some rare cases, arthritis. So it's worrisome, and it's something that, you know, deserves medical attention and treatment, but it's not like cancer or any kind of chronic condition. And in general, people are pretty satisfied that it's both self-limited and responsive to therapy.
Yet, with that in mind, why did SmithKline-Beach, MSKB, and Connaught Laboratories seek to develop vaccines in the 90s?
There was demand from the patient community, from people just living in endemic areas, as well as from some physicians who treat Lyme disease, for a vaccine. It's always good to prevent rather than cure. And there was a sense that the environment of Cape Cod, of eastern Long Island, would feel less toxic if one had protection against the disease.
And that certainly supports arguments that have been made for an array of vaccines.
Yes. And we're entering a new era of, you know, personalized medicine, where both treatments as well as preventive things like vaccines are increasingly being designed for small populations. The Lyme disease vaccine is more in that class, and it's a little bit of a brave new world because we haven't developed that many actual products that are personalized. There was a good deal of skepticism at the time of its initial regulatory review by the FDA as well as the CDC's Committee on Immunization Practices over it being, and I'll use a kind of term they used in the discussions, it being a kind of yuppie vaccine. And, you know, what they meant by that was, you know, it's for the worried well.
Yes.
It's not really going to prevent a fatal disease that we don't have treatment for. But there was concern at the time of regulation, I think mostly about diluting the trust the country has in the whole vaccination program. And there's a lot of concern about undermining that trust with sort of non-essential vaccines or things that seem like they're being pushed by drug manufacturers and stuff like that. And I think that's a very legitimate concern that regulators have.
Does the medical community, medical establishment, Dr. Aronowitz, is there a belief that a Lyme disease vaccine is even needed?
The best way to characterize the medical community is that they don't care a lot either way. I just don't think there's that much of an interest. You know, it's not like a vaccine for malaria or AIDS or something of that sort. Having said that, there are others who think we should do this. The science is there. You know, the original vaccine had a very interesting, almost sexy mechanism of action. In general, it's very hard to develop a vaccine against a disease which the body itself doesn't produce lasting immunity to. I have had Lyme disease twice. You can get it again. So how do you develop a vaccine, you know, if you can't even produce natural immunity? Well, this vaccine that was developed by the two drug companies had an ingenious mechanism. It worked on the tick, not on the human. Now, no vaccine is 100% effective. Neither was this.
Is there a path forward that you see for a Lyme disease vaccine in this country?
The same exact vaccine that was withdrawn in the U.S. is used successfully in dogs. I am wary about ever successfully marketing a Lyme disease vaccine because the underlying elements of the controversy have not only not changed, I would say they've gotten even more dug in the intervening years. And I don't have a magic wand to predict the future, but I see no reason for there not being opposition to this vaccine by the Lyme disease community along similar lines if it went through stages of development and licensing in the U.S.
Dr. Robert Aronowitz with the University of Pennsylvania, where he's a physician and a medical historian. What a convoluted and fascinating public health issue. Thank you so much for being with us, Doctor.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This Thursday, the Regional Transit Authority, the RTA of Southeast Michigan, is expected to make a final decision on whether to let residents vote on its latest proposal to expand public transit. Barring a last-minute change of heart from Oakland County leader L. Brooks Patterson and Macomb County's Mark Hackle, voters will likely not get the chance to weigh in. Meanwhile, Southeast Michigan continues to rank as one of the worst metro areas for public transit in the country. And this would come as no surprise to anyone who's had to use buses to get to Novi. This suburb northwest of Detroit is one example of the challenges building a strong public transportation system in Southeast Michigan. Here with us now is Gwen Markham of the Novi City Council. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
If I needed to take a bus to work at my job, let's say at 12 Oaks Mall, what happens if I take that bus?
If you're coming from east of the city and you take a bus, you can come to Farmington, Haggerty Road and 12 Mile, or Haggerty Road and 10 Mile, and there is a bus stop there where the smart buses end. So if you work in Novi, you get off that bus and then you walk or get a ride, or you bring your bike and you take your bike off the bus and you ride your bike to work. So if you work at 12 Oaks Mall and you get off at the bus stop at 12 and Hagerty, that's over a mile and a half that you're walking to get to work. And people do it every day.
So why did Novi choose to opt out of SMART?
Well, I have read the history. It happened in 1995. At the time, it seems like there was some concern as to whether SMART was really going to be economically viable. Were they going to make it? And I think the final decision really turned on whether Novi was going to be able to retain senior transit money if they opted into SMART. And so they opted out. And we've never gone back and revisited the question at all.
And years have passed.
23 years. The city has doubled in size.
All right. So here we are. It's taken since the early 1990s for consideration of public transit in Novi to regain traction. Why has it taken this long?
I think for a long time, people who have been there a long time didn't really feel how fast and how big the city was growing. And so for many years, there's been this prevailing idea that, well, Novi doesn't really need buses and doesn't really want buses. And we had to break through that. When the RTA vote took place in 2016, there were 25,000 votes cast in Novi. It lost by only 800 votes. So that said to me and several of the other city leaders, it's not really true to say there's not interest in Novi. We didn't even publicize it or promote it, and yet it almost passed.
It almost passed. And Cranes Detroit recently quoted Novi Mayor Bob Gatt as being, his quote was, "I'm on the SMART train." So what would have to happen for Novi to opt into the SMART bus system?
I'm not completely sure exactly what has to happen at this point in time. I know our city manager has asked our attorney to kind of weigh in. Would it be just a vote of the council like it was to opt out? Or is, since it's a millage, is it something that we would want the voters to decide? And then there's this question of, is it SMART? Is it the regional transit? And how do those two intersect?
When you mention millage, what would be the price tag, do you think?
Well, the SMART millage across the region is one mil.
That's right.
The RTA millage is a mil and a half. Mm-hmm. For Novi, who doesn't currently have SMART, how do those two intersect? You know, there's some questions that need to be answered. But for me, having bus service being talked about and something that we think we want to really try to move into is a great move, and I'm happy to see it.
Now, when you think, we were talking about SMART, and we're also talking about the Regional Transit Authority, the RTA. Where do you stand on, is there pros and cons to either one? You say it's not an either-or issue in your view.
Right. Well, as I understand the RTA, it builds upon the structure that exists with SMART, DDOT, RIDE in Ann Arbor, and then expands it and fills in a lot of the gaps. People describe it as an extra layer, but in some ways it can be a simplification, I think, in the long run, that everybody would have the same fare card and that sort of thing. So I think the RTA, as it's laid out and planned, is a 20-year millage. And because of that 20-year millage, they really are able to plan and project and change over time to adjust. So I think that's a big benefit and advantage to the RTA. But SMART currently provides a lot of good service. And for Novi today, if step number one is to move into SMART, I want to hear what that would take, because I think we need to be talking about transit in Novi and moving forward.
Yep. When we talk about the RTA, you have complete and total opposition from Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson and also Macomb County Executive Mark Hackle. What does the opposition of these two leaders mean toward getting RTA on the ballot for voters to have their say?
Well, as I understand the way the structure is, the board of the Regional Transit Authority consists of 9 people, and they are the ones who will vote this year to decide whether to put it on the ballot. The population of that board, 9 members, is 2 members from each county, Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, and Washtenaw, and a member from the city of Detroit. To put it on the ballot, there have to be 7 yes votes, and each government entity has to have at least 1 positive vote. So right now, Brooks Patterson and Mark Hackle have both said that they are not recommending that their 2 voters on uh-huh. this board vote yes.
Brooks Patterson has said, we've got SMART. SMART's good enough. We don't need the RTA. Are you hearing people say, wait a minute, we'd like a chance to vote on the RTA?
I don't think people understand it. I really don't. I think there's been enough smoke thrown and enough emotion surrounding some of the discussions that people don't know. And I did talk to a SMART official who's a little bit concerned that because their millage is this August and then the RTA proposal is in November, it will confuse the voters and hurt both. And I think that's a viable concern. I think that's got to be part of the discussion that the leadership is having. But fundamentally, we need to move buses along. If Novi opted into SMART, we'd still have problems with getting people who work who live in Novi and work, say, in Livonia or in Detroit or some of the, not Detroit, but some of the opt-out communities. They still can't get from one to another.
Say from Novi to Bloomfield Hills.
Novi to Bloomfield Hills. Even Novi to Livonia, you know. The buses don't stop in Livonia. So there's a lot of holes that need to be plugged. I think if we opt in, if Troy opts in, and some of the other communities do, and it becomes a more regional connectivity that people can count on, that would be great. But we don't have the frequencies that will guarantee ridership. You don't see those 15-minute, 30-minute kinds of buses coming. That's something that the RTA is really proposing. And I'll be interested to see what SMART for a mill can bring to us.
What's at stake here in your view?
I think our economy and the growth of it, and also people's ability to take jobs, grow themselves, grow their families, and really move where they want to move to in their life and their career. We have students in Novi who go to Oakland Community College, Schoolcraft College, Wayne State, and Lawrence Tech. They should be able to get on a bus and get to school and back every day, and they can't right now. Those are the kinds of things that I see are going to be a difference. I think our businesses really want their workforce to have more reliable transportation because that's better for everybody.
Gwen Markham on the Novi City Council. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
The sci-fi comedy Sorry to Bother You is now playing in theaters nationwide after debuting to great praise at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's a story of a young black telemarketer from Oakland named Cassius Green, played by Lakeith Stanfield. In this scene, an older coworker, played by Danny Glover, offers advice that helps Cassius climb the ladder to telemarketing success.
You want to make some money here? Then read the script with the white boys.
People say I talk with a white voice anyway, so why ain't it helping me out?
Well, you don't talk white enough. I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. I'm talking about the real deal, like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer, this is Langston from Regalview. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
The film is the directorial debut of musician Boots Riley, who's with us now, who grew up in Oakland. But Boots, you spent some early years in Detroit, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, I lived in Detroit until I was six, so I went to Hampton Elementary, and I lived on Stopel Street. So I say that because those are the things you know when you're in kindergarten. I live on Stopel Street. I go to Hampton. You know, so I don't have an idea exactly where that is. Somebody told me that's on the west side.
It is. It is. Actually, I went to school right near Stopel Street, northwest Detroit area. I know exactly where you grew up. And so it's rather significant. One of the main characters in your film, played by Tessa Thompson, is Cassius' girlfriend. Her name is Detroit. So why did you make that choice? And how did you ensure she lived up to that name?
Well, in the movie, she says, my parents wanted me to have an American name. And I feel like the history of Detroit with the promise of the rewards of capitalism with the auto industry and the betrayal of the people by the corporations and the struggle and the music and, you know, there's so many parts of it. is really representative of a lot of the larger American history. And, you know, that's why I had it that her parents named her that. And, you know, I think that what she lives up to is kind of this creative spark that is in Detroit, and this while at the same time being down to earth.
Yeah, and certainly you've got that context with the early Detroit roots and then growing up and working in Oakland.
And I have a lot of family that still live
okay.
in Detroit. But also I would say that it's often said, and I believe it to be true, that Oakland and Detroit are very similar. So
tell us how.
I think in the way that the people are, you know, like, you know, you walk down the street, people talk to each other in Oakland, and it feels that same way in Detroit. I think that also in the sense that when you talk about black folks in Oakland and black folks in Detroit, as opposed to like Los Angeles or something like that, or New York, black folks more recently came from the South. So there is something to the culture that has to do with that as well.
And I know for this past opening weekend, Boots, you did Q&As after screenings, including one in the Detroit area. Why Detroit on opening weekend?
Well, we did two in the Detroit area. Just because we're leaving no stone unturned, is honestly, but also it's a city that I want to make sure sees this movie.
And I know, yeah, well, because of, as you say, exploring the rewards and the betrayal of capitalism, for one thing, that's a big theme in this film.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's also a theme of actually, you know, workers organizing themselves, and that being a key to other things that are even thought of as a wider social justice struggle, but that being a key to it. And so it's really, you know, I think it's something that, even though the location is in Oakland, the setting is everywhere in the United States.
And Boots Riley, I know you've been kind of laboring on this film for like 6-7 years. So the film is not about Donald Trump and Donald Trump's America, but here it is. It's hitting theaters at a time in our country that is hyper-politically charged, where just about every week we see a cell phone video of a white person all wrapped up in white privilege calling police on people of color who are just like living, having a barbecue, or trying to get into the swim club, which they're a member of, or trying to sell bottled water. And in the midst of this comes Sorry to Bother You. What are you hoping that your film will add to this national debate about race?
Well, I think that what this film does is, a lot of times, we look at all these problems as just this litany of terrible things, which they are, actually. However, this film attempts to say that there's an organized way to look at these problems, and which comes from a perspective that things can be changed, and that in the end, these problems stem from a source. They stem, you know, we live in capitalism. The motor of capitalism is the exploitation of labor. And from that, there is a utility to racism that helps capitalism keep going. So if we know that unemployment is built into the capitalist system, then we know that poverty is built into the capitalist system. And what these racist tropes attempt to do is to explain that the reasons for poverty are because of the bad choices of those folks. And so a lot of what this movie attempts to do is say that although there are all these messed up things happening, there is a way for us to change things. And there's a way for us to do it from a place of power and where we are right now. We don't have to just ask the powers that be to do things. We can demand it and exact financial consequences. And I'm not just talking about boycotts. I'm talking about actual withholding of labor. And that's what this movie touches on.
And in the sense of this sci-fi comedy about a telemarketer, it's worth noting you actually spent time working as a telemarketer. What did that teach you about that white voice that you built into this film?
Yeah, I definitely had to use a version, my version of a white voice. And in the movie, he develops a magical way to make his voice sound like it's overdubbed by a white actor. And the lead character is played by Lakeith Stanfield. David Cross does his white voice. And what I'm talking about are like very serious issues right now. But the movie is a wild and fun and hilarious movie. And I don't think that contradicts the seriousness of it. Like, if you ever read Richard Pryor's book, Prior Convictions, the beginning of each chapter starts with one of his well-known bits. Like, he'll just pick a bit, and it'll be something that you know that you remember Richard Pryor did that's hilarious. The rest of the chapter will be all the terrible, horrible things that happened to him that will make you cry, but that created that comedy bit.
You open the door with laughter and then dive into the issue, and that certainly is done in this film, Sorry to Bother You, writer-director Boots Riley. The film is in theaters now, and we want to thank you so much, Boots Riley, for taking time to talk with us on Stateside today.
Thank you for having me. I also want to say, like, we have an amazing cast. Lakeith Stanfield, Tessa Thompson, Steven Yeun, Terry Crews, Danny Glover, Armie Hammer, Jermaine Fowler, they're all at the top of their game here. So I'm hoping people will check it out.
Thank you so much, Boots.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Sophie Sherry, and Sam Corey. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.